From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. And tonight, we are lucky enough to have Congresswoman Jackie Speier on The Breakdown. This week marks 40 years since she was shot and left for dead on an airstrip in Guyana. And Speier is here to talk about her life and many traumas she's overcome.
Yeah, she's got a new memoir out called Undaunted. Quite a list of tragedies she's had to overcome. We'll talk with her about that. But first, Marisa, the election. Yeah, it was like 9 days ago. Seems like
is
a lifetime ago. I know. So far, the Democrats doing very well. This is kind of like a slow-moving car crash for the Republicans as the results continue to trickle in. The Democrats now have succeeded in flipping 5 seats total.
That's right.
Just this afternoon, the AP called Katie Porter, the Democrat in Orange County, the winner over Mimi Walters down there. We visited that district back in October.
And I was lucky enough to sit down with Congresswoman-elect Porter, but couldn't get a call back from Walters.
Never called us back.
And, you know, she's not the only one, obviously, with 5 seats and the one still in play. We've seen the Dems pick up Jeff Denham's seat out in Modesto just this week. Josh Harder took that race. Dana Rohrabacher lost his seat in Huntington Beach to Harley Ruda. And, you know, it's interesting because I think that there was a sense on election night that maybe California wouldn't be as important to Democrats. And now it's really looking like that's really helping that margin for them.
It is. But can you imagine what we'd be going through right now if control of the House were still up in the air?
Well, and already, I mean, I think it's important to point out that both Young Kim, who is in this race with Gil Cisneros up in Orange County, still hasn't been called, but Cisneros did take the lead today, the Democrat. Young Kim and Mimi Walters have been raising these questions about, you know, voter fraud and saying that because the results are different than what they were on election night,
which
maybe
is silly.
They're wrong,
it's ridiculous.
Which is completely unfounded. We know data. I have some data for you, Scott.
Proof.
I mean, we just know that, you know, later votes tend to skew Democratic.
They
and we
do.
Have a lot of people voting by mail now, a lot of people voting provisionally, and it takes time.
It does. And I spoke to one Republican operative today who said that they knew on election night that they did not have a big enough margin to hold on to these seats. It looked pretty good for them on election night, but those who knew thought, we're not going to be able to hold on to this.
Which really makes it even more cynical, I think, to you know, because regardless of your party, when you call into question the democratic system and sort of sow seeds of doubt in people's minds, it's really dangerous. And we're not just seeing this here. We're seeing it in Florida, in Georgia.
Yeah. And unfortunately, sadly, it is part of a trend of denigrating institutions, the FBI, the media, the courts. And so now it's come home to California.
Well, let's put some of this in context. The DCCC, the Democratic Committee, sent out a memo today sort of crowing about their wins.
Drew Godnich's victory lap.
Yes, he was on our show a couple months ago and says, you know, I told you guys first we were going to flip these seats. He says if they all go blue, which is looking more and more likely, it will be the most seats the Democrats have flipped in California since 1962. We should also note that they secured not just 2/3, but potentially like 3/4 majorities in the state legislature.
Yeah, it's crazy. Things are looking good for Gavin Newsom, although as we've said before, might be a mixed blessing to have that many Democratic votes up there. And you know what? It's kind of interesting. It's just a little fun fact. John Cox beat Gavin Newsom in Orange County.
Barely, though.
Barely.
In
fact, in the end, he may end up losing because he's just, you know, like these other races, he's probably falling, the margin is probably narrowing.
Yeah.
But point is, you know, Orange County, you know, it's not.
It's purple.
It's purple. Yeah, it has not gone like deep blue.
No, it hasn't. But if you look at the voter turnout, I think it does speak to what Democrats had been saying, which is that's what they needed. They needed to turn folks out, not just try to sort of cut into the GOP base. And I think there's an interesting conversation happening now among Republicans and conservatives in California about what the future holds. I mean, we've seen their registration numbers plummet, the amount of offices they've held in California really go down. And Kristen Olson, who we've also had on the show, Stanislaus County Supervisor, former leader of the Republicans in the state assembly, wrote an op-ed this week proclaiming the GOP in California is, and this is a quote, no longer salvageable.
And, you know, the problem for them, too, is that with Donald Trump as president, he sucks all the oxygen out of the room. And it's hard to distinguish yourself or to get away from, you know, whatever. I mean, in some places it's an advantage for Republicans, but it is not an advantage in California.
But I think it's important to note, and I saw some prominent Republicans saying that a lot of these problems existed before Trump in California for the GOP.
The
and I think it's just made it more clear for them.
Right. But even like Jeff Denham, you know, who tried to distance himself from the president on things like DACA, the Dreamers, it looks he has gone down to defeat as well to Josh Harder over there in the Modesto area.
Well, we'll talk about this a lot more in the coming weeks, I'm sure.
We will, but we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Congresswoman Jackie Speier. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. And joining us now is Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier, first elected to Congress in 2008. She represents part of San Francisco and San Mateo counties, and she has a new memoir. It's titled Undaunted, Surviving Jonestown, Summoning Courage, and Fighting Back. Congresswoman Speier, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for coming in.
So you were born in 1950. We have a tradition on this show.
I'm 68 years old.
Okay, yeah.
Get that out of the way.
You know, we have a sort of a tradition of beginning with our guest's childhood, and you grew up in San Francisco. And I'm just wondering, you know, your parents were both children of immigrants. What did they instill on you in you, and like how did they shape the person you are today?
Well, in so many ways that it didn't become clear to me until I wrote the memoir that I was much more like them than not. And yet I saw myself as having, you know, advanced beyond as they would have wanted me to do. I mean, neither of them went to college, and they wanted their children to have that opportunity. And I felt that my life was different, but in many respects, my life is formed by their two, you know, gritty personalities and strong-mindedness and love of this country, because they had such a powerful story, each of them, and from very different backgrounds.
Well, it seemed like reading your book, though, that you did have some difficulty in school. You were bullied. That's what we would call it now, I think.
Girls and in my time in third, fourth, fifth grade were cooties. We were all cooties. But somehow I got designated as the queen of the cooties. So they hated me more than all the other girls. And the most humiliating experience was in the fourth grade, I believe, fourth or fifth grade, when the May Day dance came about, the Maypole dance. And the boys got to select the girls that they wanted to dance with. And nobody selected me.
That's the worst.
So yeah. I had to run the phonograph machine.
Oh, wow.
For the May Day dance.
Teachers didn't do a lot to step in and help back then,
huh?
Sounds like a different kind of dodgeball.
Yeah.
So you were in high school when you first got involved with Leo Ryan. He was running for the state assembly. How did you make that connection?
So there's a mail that comes. It's a solicitation to support Assemblyman Ryan. For some reason, I picked up the mail that day. I saw the form. I filled it out, kind of audacious, I guess. Said, I don't have any money, but I'm a 16-year-old kid and, you know, would like to volunteer. So I remember this so vividly. Every Saturday morning, I had to vacuum the house. I hated that job. And I'm vacuuming the house. The phone rings. The vacuum cleaner is still going. And I pick up the phone, talk to this person on the other end of the phone. He says, well, you know, we got your card. We'd like to interview you. Can you come to this address? And so I said, sure. So I drive to this address in Millbrae in the hills. And lo and behold, it's Assemblyman Ryan's home. And there's five or six of his campaign supporters there interviewing. And all of a sudden, they say, well, go to this address in San Bruno and pick up my uniform or costume. And all of a sudden I was a Ryan girl. It pains me.
Can
now
you
to
imagine
say that.
These days?
What was the costume?
So, this was height of the Beatlemania. So it was a miniskirt, houndstooth miniskirt, little bobby hat, houndstooth, black turtleneck sweater, and black tights, and white boots.
Go-go boots.
Wow. You probably remember this, but Hillary Clinton was a Goldwater girl. I don't know if she had go-go boots.
Oh, no, she didn't, because my girlfriend, who is still my girlfriend today, was a young Republican and campaign for Goldwater during the time that I was campaigning for Leo Ryan.
I'm curious. I know there's a moment in the book where you talk about, you know, being this unpaid intern and thinking about how hard your parents have worked and just saying, I can't do this. Like, I can't work for you anymore for free. And thinking they would say, okay, be on your way. And it just struck me that that seems like one of the first moments as a woman that you really stood up for yourself in that way. And I don't know, were you, did that make you nervous, or it was just like, I got to do this. I can't be working for free.
I did it because it was just the reality. It was a great internship. I had learned a lot, but I really needed to get a paying job to help defray the costs of college, as inexpensive as it was back right. then. And lo and behold, then Assemblyman Ryan says, well, let me see what I can do. And he goes down to Rules Committee and gets me on staff as a part-time assistant.
Wow. And then we'll go into all the things you did.
So he gets elected to Congress in 1972, I think it was, Richard Nixon got reelected that year. And you go back to D.C. eventually to work for him. What was it like for a young woman to be walking the halls of Congress back in
that era? Well, it was exciting. It was, a great opportunity. But again, then one morning I wake up and say, do I really want to be a political hack the rest of my life? And
what did that mean to you?
Well,
political
just,
hack.
Well, I wanted more. I didn't mean that pejoratively. It was just I didn't want to do this the rest of my life. And so I, basically went to Leo Ryan and said, I really think I want to go back to law school.
And then eventually you went back and were hired as his legislative counsel.
Correct.
And you had worked for him for many years. You guys were, very close professionally. And you ended up being just one of a handful of staffers that decided to go down with him to Jonestown.
Well, it wasn't like I got to decide necessarily. There were two staffers, one from the committee, and then he wanted me to come as a member of his staff. I was very nervous about making
the trip.
You got
a bad feeling about it.
Well, and let's just, for people who may not know what Jonestown was. So Jim Jones was a very charismatic minister in San Francisco, started the People's Temple, and moved this, hundreds of people from San Francisco, the Bay Area mostly, down to Guyana, Jonestown, called it Jonestown. And your office began to get letters and calls, right, about the concerns from relatives.
And he had been very active politically in San Francisco, too, right? So he was...
Well known.
Jim
well
Jones
known.
Yeah. was sometimes credited as having prevented the recall of then Mayor George Moscone, because he had 2,000 members in his congregation at the time, and at a moment's notice could put all of those members of the congregation walking precincts. So everyone looked the other way. Marshall Kilduff wrote the piece in New West magazine because the Chronicle would not print it. And that's when he decided that he was going to take a good part of his congregation down to Jonestown. He had started building Jonestown in the mid-70s.
So he was feeling the heat from the coverage, the media coverage?
So the media coverage, Congressman Ryan had been talked to by concerned relatives. These were parents of mostly young adults who had gotten involved in Jonestown, defectors who had left Jonestown, Grace Stone, Tim Stone, Debbie Blakey. And we interviewed many of them. And so there was a real sense that Congressman Ryan had that there's something going on down here and we are not getting an accurate assessment. State Department had visited and said, oh, no, everything's great. Can't understand why you want to go down there.
And I mean, it was interesting, though, too, because the State Department, it's not just in San Francisco that it seemed like he had connections. Why do you think the federal government was so unconcerned with this? Yeah.
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that question. I think that there might have been some interest in wanting to keep the leader then, whose name was Burnham, he was the prime minister and had close ties with Jim Jones, keep him happy. It's the dictator you know versus the dictator you don't. Bauxite was being imported to the United States from Guyana. It was the source of aluminum. It's unclear to me, but there was not a willingness, even with defectors who came to the embassy in Georgetown, Guyana, talking about that they had endured, there wasn't enough for them to take it all that seriously.
What was it? You said you had misgivings. You had a gut feeling that going down there was going to be problematic. What was it?
Think,
was it just like an intuition?
Well, it was in part. I mean, I remember spending one weekend at the office just listening to all these audio tapes of interviews that had been done by local staff in the Bay Area and being just feeling like we did not know enough that, you know, they talked about gun running. They talk about sexual abuse and physical abuse. They talked about these white knight trails. I was about to buy a condo in Arlington, Virginia, and I made the contract contingent on my surviving the trip. And then later I found this. I had forgotten about it. I had left a note in my desk to my parents with a little reference to this $1,000 life insurance policy I had with the local credit union.
Did you share those concerns with Congressman Ryan or anybody?
I did. He says, oh, Jackie, there's nothing to worry about. He really thought, you know, there's no member of Congress that had ever been assassinated in the line of duty abroad. So why be concerned?
So when you guys got down there and you finally got to Jonestown, it seemed like for a little bit things didn't seem that bizarre, but tell us what struck you as you sort of as that first day went on.
So we were sitting in the back of the pavilion on a picnic benches and interviewing family members of constituents. So these were young adults for the most part who had left their families, cut off relationships, and many of them we had letters to give to them from their parents, and they all said the same thing, particularly the young girls. They said, I'm very happy here. No, I don't want to, you know, talk to my parents or communicate with them. There's nothing I really have to say to them. And by the way, I'm getting married. You know, 18, 19 year olds. And they all said the same thing. So there was a roteness to it that really was peculiar.
In retrospect, made more sense. Right. Kind of cult-like, obviously.
And, you know, when Congressman Ryan stood up and said, it looks like so many of you are very happy here, the place erupted in applause. But it was frenetic almost. And it went on for a long period of time. There was something very artificial about it.
And it was something that was said to a reporter along the trip that really kind of made the turn for you guys.
So Don Harris was walking from NBC, was walking around the pavilion smoking a cigarette, and someone slipped him a note with two names saying, we want to get out of here. So at the end of the evening, Don comes over and shows us this note, and my heart sank. I thought, oh my God, it's everything I feared. There are people being held here against their will.
And then as time went by, there were more people.
More and more people wanted to leave. And what's lost oftentimes in the recounting the stories of Jonestown is that there were about 40 more people that wanted to leave. Congressman Ryan was staying behind because we were going to have to get a second set of planes to come up. And so he was going to be part of the second airlift out. And I was taking the first group to the airstrip to go back to Georgetown. And then there was a knifing attempt on Congressman Ryan. And so they stopped the truck. He came down, got into the cab of the truck. I was in the bed of the truck. And we went to the airstrip.
And that's where the attack happened on you guys.
That's right.
So before that, though, did you guys go up to Jim Jones and say, you know, people want to leave, we're taking them with us? Or it sounded like the whole thing was just very chaotic.
Well, it started to build up. At first, there were just two, and then there was a whole family. The matriarch was probably in her 70s, but there was she and her son and his wife and their children, and then more and more people. And so Don Harris from NBC was interviewing Jim Jones, and he said, people are lying. You know, they can go if they want. You know, we've heard all of that tape over and over again. But
so what happened? You get back to the plane and suddenly there's gunshots.
So I'm loading passengers onto the two planes. And so my back is to the tractor trailer, which had followed from behind and was now on the airstrip. And so I didn't even comprehend what was happening when the gunshots were first being fired. And then I turned around and Ryan had been hit. And so I'm running towards him. And then he got hit again and fell to the ground. And I ran underneath one of the wheels of the plane.
And had you been hit yourself
at that
point? No,
I had not been hit at that point.
But you were ultimately struck by what, five bullets?
Five bullets. Still carry two.
Wow, they're still in you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And it took you guys, a day or two to get out of
there. 22 hours without medical attention.
How did you survive?
I have no idea. It wasn't my turn. I mean, my whole right thigh was blown up. I mean, it was like the size of a football hole, and my arm had a bone coming out from the gunshot. And I should have, if the femoral artery had been severed, I would have died in 90 seconds. Again, there was a plan. It wasn't my turn. And, you know, because I had that experience, because I came so close to death and survived, it has actually informed so much of my life and what I've done with it.
Yeah.
Well, you, to fast forward a little bit, you had a career in the legislature. You served in the assembly. In the
well,
state
she came
Senate.
Back and ran for that Congress seat.
Oh, well, right, yes.
And lost.
And lost. Yeah, yeah. And that sounded like sort of a bitter campaign a little bit, because the family, Leo Ryan's family, took different sides with
That's
different
right.
candidates. Yeah.
Do you feel like in hindsight you were still in shock? I mean.
Sure, I was. Of course I was. But it was in my own mind, I realized I needed to do this for emotional stability. I needed to get on with my life. Yeah. I didn't want to be a Guyana survivor the rest of my life. So it was helpful to me to
and maybe in some ways a blessing that you didn't get elected, because it enabled you to get all this other experience before you ultimately did go to Congress.
Yeah, I had no intentions of ever going back to Congress. It was 29 years later. I have the record of the longest time for the first time to the second time and winning.
Right, because you served on the Board of Supervisors, State Assembly, State Senate.
Ran for Lieutenant Governor, lost.
Yeah. That
one
race.
Of the three times I've lost. I love to tell young people this is what a three-time loser looks like.
And in that time in the legislature, you met and fell in love with your husband, Steve. You guys had a baby. And I know one of the things that struck me is you talked about, as a state lawmaker, bringing your baby to meetings because you didn't have maternity leave,
mm-hmm,
and breastfeeding him. I mean, it struck a sort of personal chord with me. I took my baby to the DNC a couple of years ago when he was 5 months old. But I was thinking how much, I mean, more remarkable that was for you at that stage. I mean, you had to have been the only lawmaker who was doing that.
I was the first lawmaker to have a baby while in office, yeah. You had to get passes to get off the floor. I got a permanent pass from Willie Brown so I could go.
You guys mended fences.
Yeah, we did mend fences. He did not want me to get elected. But, you know, when my husband was killed in an automobile accident, and that was 14 years after Jonestown, I was so devastated. I mean, I can't begin to tell you how much harder it was to deal with that than Guyana, because I'd lost the love of my life. I was now a widow. I had one 5.5-year-old, and I was pregnant with a second, and it was a high-risk pregnancy. And I was financially a basket case, because I was 3 months from personal bankruptcy, because he was the breadwinner, and we had bought our dream house and hadn't sold our other. It was horrific. I could almost not breathe.
How'd you get through it?
I can't imagine.
I talk about the three Fs: family, friends, and faith. People, and you have to be willing to come forward and ask people for what you need. I mean, that's one of the lessons of this book, too.
Yeah, it does strike me how the women that supported you. But I think for our listeners, they should know, too. I mean, before your husband died, you had also gone through some huge traumas, two miscarriages, one of which was very late term, adopting a baby and then having the birth mother take him back. I mean,
I remember after the birth mother came to pick up the baby in Sacramento, and I'm driving home and I'm sobbing. And I called Steve, who was working at the ER, and I said, "Why do these bad things keep happening to us?" And he was always such a upbeat person. And he said, "No, wait a minute. We have each other. We have this wonderful son. We have our health, and we can try again." Well, you know, I am now in my 40s, right? And what was the likelihood of me getting pregnant?
And one of the reasons was because you had a bullet, right, in your pelvis that made it difficult?
They thought it was, but it wasn't the bullet. In the end, it was just age. You know, it was the specialist who said, well, based on the age of your eggs and your medical history, because I had had these two miscarriages, you have a 10% chance of getting pregnant with in vitro. What were the chances of getting pregnant naturally?
Remarkable.
Next to none.
Well, let's talk about how all of this, I think, impacted, you know, your work, which has been also, we haven't even talked about any of her legislative victories.
Right, right. Yeah, so you get elected to Congress in 2008. Tom Lantos, who had been in the seat, died of cancer, I think it was, and you fill out his term and then you get reelected overwhelmingly. So how did all these experiences shape the kind of legislator that you have become, do you think?
I think we bring our personal experiences to our legislative work. I mean, for instance, when I lost the adoption, I reduced the length of time that he would wait to know whether or not you were going to be able to adopt a baby. In my case, it wouldn't have made a difference, but I could recognize, you know, the impact that that would have on families.
I wonder, too, I mean, some of the things that struck me in the book was everybody does bring their personal experiences in terms of how it informs their work, but you've also been very open about talking about those personal experiences, first in the state legislature on gun control, in D.C. around abortion rights and other reproductive rights. And I just wonder how that's been received, because I don't think it's always common for lawmakers to make things so personal.
Well, I'm sure it's been received in a mixed fashion from people. But I think more than anything, people want you to be authentic. And I like to think there's an authenticity to sharing those stories, because you at least understand why someone feels that way. I mean, when I was carrying the assault weapon ban in the state legislature, and one of my colleagues asked me a question and says, "Ms. Speer, have you ever shot an assault weapon?" I thought, are you kidding me? And he said it again. And so I thought, all right, I'm going to give it right back, and said to him, "Let me just ask you a question. Have you ever been shot by an assault weapon?" And then I launched into why I had. And then the bill gets off the assembly floor, goes to then Governor Pete Wilson, and gets signed into law. Now, look at where that issue has gone since then. You know, we had a Republican governor signing that bill.
Yeah, you talk a lot about the difference between Sacramento and going to D.C. and how you sort of felt like when you got into Congress that, you know, you could just work hard and get things done. And that has not been the case over the last 10, 15 years there. But Democrats did just win back the House. Are you more hopeful given, you know, what the at least the dynamic in D.C. will be a little different than the last 2 years?
Oh, there's no question. It's going to be much improved. You know, I served for 2 years when we were in the majority, but I've spent 8 years in the minority, and it has nothing to recommend itself. So, yes, no, there's some opportunities now. But again, we still have the Senate, which is going to be a majority Republican. So things, unfortunately, I think are going to be stalled.
Before we let you go.
Fun question.
Yes. We know that your favorite holiday from your book is Halloween.
Yes.
We just celebrated Halloween. How did you celebrate?
You know, I did not get to celebrate Halloween this year.
What?
Because I was starting this book tour. So, but I do. I have a wonderful gorilla costume and a number of, I've got three tubs in the garage of Halloween costumes. So if anyone needs anything, yeah, just let me know.
Well, I was going to offer, if you want to come over and take all the candy my kids got, please do.
All right. Congresswoman Jackie Speer, her new book is called Undaunted. Thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you.
Oh, great to be with you. Thank you.
And that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer is Seal Muller.
Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our chief content officer.
I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. That's a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time.